Heinberg back for DigitalTrends.com, and I am here with horror impresario Clive Barker, novelist, filmmaker, creator of Hellraiser, and now he's getting back into video games after a six-year hiatus with Jericho for the PlayStation 3 and Xbox 360 from Codemasters. Clive, how the hell are you doing?
I'm doing well, Max. I'm doing actually really well. We got, I guess the game is Halloween, so we've got a few weeks yet, but I'm excited. I'm stoked.
Well, good. You seem to be quite the underachiever, though. I mean, novels, movies, you created Hellraiser, you've got comic books. Why video games?
There are things that each of those media provide or give the artist a chance to do, which the others don't. Plainly, a haiku, a Japanese poem, what is it, 14 syllables or 17 syllables, can achieve a tiny but beautiful thing, whereas War and Peace achieves something completely different. And neither is better than the other, they're just different. And I feel the same about the media I work in. I spend the day. Today I've done some film stuff. I'm writing a novel right now. When I finish talking with you, Scott, I'm going to go next door to paint. So it's a chance to balance everything off. So today will have been a games, painting, movie, writing day.
Except for the fact that I think in this game you paint the walls with blood. Is that pretty apt?
Well, whatever. Walls are still standing. Yes, it's a pretty bloody game. It's a shockingly bloody game, even for me. I think those things change. I think we get used to particularly fake blood. And there's a need to keep moving the benchmark and to keep the shock value up. I will happily admit to that. I think it's part of what horror storytelling, in the broadest sense, games, movies, books, should do. There should be an element of shock. There should be an element of, oh, I don't know whether I want to look at that or not.
Gotcha. Now, would we have wanted to look at your last one, Demonic, which got canceled at a rather impromptu stage?
I was brought in, as you perhaps know, late in the day to, help with a project which was not happening the way people wanted it to. And then it all got canceled, which was a bit of a heartbreaker for me because I put a lot of work and love into it, and I got to work with David Finch, who's an extraordinary artist, and that was wonderful. But, when things, it's very seldom I get involved in something and it doesn't somehow or other come to fruition finally. It may take years, but finally I'll get there. And the other thing is, it just makes your appetite for the next thing more acute, so that when we decided to do Jericho, there was a real hunger in me to get back to the gaming arena and to do something that was genuinely intense and threatening and hopefully had a narrative that was intriguing and a little bit off the beaten track. I'd seen a lot of the war games that had been done by a number of people that I knew, and I was incredibly impressed by their accuracy. And I thought, boy, it would be great just to take the wonderful reality, the wonderful sense of you are there in the middle of this. That comes from these war games and apply it to a fantastic or supernatural idea, because that way you get the firefight heat. I mean, I've watched people literally sweat playing this game, pouring down their faces, totally knitted into the narrative, unwilling to let anybody say, it's all right, it's just a game, it's just a game. Usually the answer is, no, it's not. Leave me alone. It's very fun. I mean, I think the sense of commitment that you can get from a player is unique to the gaming environment. It's not the same as a book or a movie. A book you play a book you read very quietly in some quiet place. Obviously, movies you tend to see, even if it's a DVD you bring home, you tend to see it with other people. A game has that solitude, at least, a single shooter game like this that will have a multiplayer version long very soon, allows you to just get into the world on your own and play in that world for 15 hours. And it is, actually, it's worlds. It's worlds within worlds within worlds.
Now, you seem to come up with an awful lot of these worlds, most of them dark, bloody, and prone to S&M. So I'm curious how Jericho fits into the overall pantheon or canon of Clive Barker work.
Well, I'm firstly not out of any desire to say I don't like horror, because I do love horror. I want you to point you in the direction of The Thief of Always and the Aberrat books and Imagica and Weave Worlds. In other words, huge novels that are very far from the worlds of Hellraiser and Candyman and Jericho. In fact, I think part of one of the reasons I do go so dark and so extreme when I do enter those areas is because there's another Clive Barker who writes for children. And Thief of Always is taught in schools across America. I'm just in front of me right now is Aberrat 3, which is the third in a series of five novels, which are now in 42 languages. And that's a very different me. So when I get loosed into my my mature adults only playground, I feel ready to play the darkest games, because there's a part of me which has been playing in the light. And I think maybe it's just the Libran in me, the need for balance, but I'm not sure I believe in astrology anyway, but let's say I do for the sake of the conversation. I am a Libran, I do like balance, and I, if I'm going to go to places of light and optimism, every now and then I need to go to a place of cruelty and despair.
Ah, speaking of places of cruelty and despair, rumor has it you were fairly involved in this office. Did you ever have to, or rather involved in the game production, did you have to ever whiz by the Codemasters offices? I guess I'm curious as to what degree you were involved in the making of Jericho.
Oh, very. They came to me, and actually that's not entirely true. We have on the line Mac from, I'm assuming Mac is still there. And as Mac will testify, I've been around with Codemasters, traveling and talking and plotting, not just for this game, but for games to follow. Most of the creative stuff was actually done here in the hills above Sunset in my house. And the Aberrat books are illustrated with oil paintings, and I have a house which is filled with, I think it's now something like 700 oil paintings, and that's the place which we used to, do all the creative stuff. And a lot of the creative work on the game isn't even talking, it's drawing. I mean, it's one of the fun things about having some artistic retentions. I can describe things with words and probably find they came out completely different from the way I intended, or I can make a sketch. And a sketch will very often be so much more useful than the 10,000 words you might have used to describe it.
So what sort of painting is Jericho then exactly? Abstract art, or at least it is after you splatter the walls with everyone's intent?
Yeah, you're big on the splatter here. I mean,
I do, but it's a very action-intensive game, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it is. But it also has, I think, a curious elegance to it. And I know elegance might be a weird word to use, but when you think of those landscapes, the sheer art, and I use the word advisedly, the sheer art that has gone into the creating of these environments, passing from one world into another, from one age into another, as we get closer and closer to the source of ultimate evil, there's something very beautiful about those landscapes, and therefore, in a bizarre kind of way, beautiful about the horrors that appear in their midst. I'm friends with Giga, and Giga and I have often said, when he comes to my studio, we sit and talk, and he says, he'll look at my paintings, and this one he likes, that one he doesn't. The ones he likes are always the ones that I would say my mother would think were ugly. Ugly, you know, and I wouldn't want to live with that, darling. You know, she'd be very nice about it, but, you know, it's beauty is in the eye of the beholder. I certainly see beauty in very dark images often.
Now, with games, do you see them as a new canvas that you're painting on? Are you approaching them as a novelist, as a filmmaker, as a painter? Which way do you look at them?
As a filmmaker, curiously, I think, because it really is a bunch of guys going this together. I say guys because they've all been guys on this project. I hope we'll have a transgendered member the next gang, but maybe we did and I just didn't know it.
Well, you did mention Mac.
Yeah, I mean, of course, that's absolutely true. I'd forgotten he puts on that fig beard, but he doesn't, you know, fool anybody. The where were we? Where were we?
Well, we were talking about you approaching games as a filmmaker.
The filmmaker. It requires a lot of people to do this properly, and a lot of the job is communicating with accuracy what you really want. And I'm only just beginning to understand not the politics of this, the processes of this. We have a creative team who live in Spain and speak Spanish, and I don't speak Spanish, so we have a sort of a bit of a breakdown there. They're also in Spain, which, you know, it means there are lots of places where communications can sort of fall apart. And there have been places, and I believe in sort of owning up to these things, there have been places where we've had little creative wars, no question. We had them on the music, we had them on some of the images. I don't always win, and that's fine. Yeah, you know, there's a give and take in all of this, and that's part of the process. And that's why I go back to the movie analogy, because, you know, when you're making a movie, even if you wrote and directed it, there are massive contributions made to the experience on the screen over which you have no control whatsoever, whether it's the special effect, whether it's the costumes, whether it's the makeup, whether it's the way the sky is the day that you shot it, which you can't even control because it's possible to get aligned to God. You know, it feels like that. You have to, you really have to think yourself into other people's heads and do all the other things that you should be as a good collaborator doing, which is understanding everybody's point of view.
Okay. But speaking of different points of view, you come at this as a filmmaker, as an author, somebody who's done children's work, someone who's done dark horror films. Do you ever foresee a day that games as a whole, titles like Jericho, could replace, whether it's literature or film's role in pop culture?
Not replace, never. They haven't replaced opera. They haven't replaced ballet. They haven't replaced, some of the most ancient forms of music. Medieval music is still played. So, no, I don't think replace. I think what will happen is that the technology will continue to develop. And with each technological breakthrough, I, as a storyteller, will have more options. And I think in a weird way, it may lead me more into being able to use my novelist, I was going to say skills, but that sounds immodest, you know, the stuff I know about book writing, because obviously in a game it's very hard to get the psychology of the characters as strong and as clear as it would be in a movie or in a novel. If Christopher Walken walks onto a screen, you instantly think, okay, it's trouble, right? If Michelle Pfeiffer comes on, besides going, oh, God, look at those cheekbones, you would also say, I'm going to enjoy being in the company of this person.
Mm-hmm.
She's one of those people I just love to watch, even in a movie that isn't particularly good. I don't think we have that sense of personality down yet in gaming. And I think some of it is to do with the way of, you know, rendering and how close to the human face we can get. The late Ingmar Bergman, who passed away last week, once said there is only one subject for artists, the human face.
Mm-hmm.
And while I don't disagree, I think it's the penis, the subject of the human face is nevertheless fascinating, and it's beautiful to be able to study faces and see the nuancing in them. And it's those nuances I think we still have to get in onto the screen in games.
Now, interestingly, you recently emerged as perhaps an unwitting champion of the medium, given the debate with Roger Ebert.
The Ebert thing, sure. Talk about unwitting. I knew zero about the fact that this was going on. So I think it was you, Mac, didn't you? You sent me all that printout?
Yes.
Yeah, I got this huge, I want to say it was half an inch thick of stuff that had come from not just my observations on Ebert's observations, but Ebert's observations about me, about me being a four-year-old or something, talking like a four-year-old,
mm-hmm.
something really flattering like that. And my late father had many skills, but one of his skills that almost arose to genius was his skill to write killer letters. letters that would stop people in their tracks. And you know, after they'd read them, people would have to take sharp objects from around the person's, the recipient's, you know, presence. They were really, really harsh letters. And he'd write them usually to puffed up dignitaries or people who were just, you know, a-holes and had, for some reason or other, you know, gone on the wrong side of my dad. Usually, as I say, puffed up individuals who needed taking down a peg or two. Mr. Ebert falls into this category and, challenging my beloved father's spirit, I wrote a long letter, didn't I, Mac?
Mm-hmm.
And which would have been my riposte to his riposte to my riposte to his riposte, or something like that. But then I learned, and I didn't know this, that he was sick. I didn't realize he was so seriously sick. Good taste prevailed. Everybody said, you know, don't do this. And my heart said, don't do this. So I trashed the letter. But every point that he made was brilliantly refuted by one or other of the people online who commented about Ebert's insolence. It's a pomposity that's sort of laughable in the end and is not hard to walk away from. Took me a long time to write the letter, but in the end it just wasn't worth it. He's a pompous, arrogant old man, and you know, he's not going to stop us making games or enjoying them, or, by the way, making them art.
And what exactly do you feel the ultimate potential of that art can be? Where do games have the potential to take us?
Everywhere. The same places all art can take us. If you walk into the National Gallery in London, you know, you are presented with masterpieces of Impressionism and glorious Dutch miniatures and so on and so forth. Countless styles and forms of genius represented. One day it'll be like that for games. It may be 500 years from now, maybe 100 years from now, I suspect closer to 100. And we will be looking at these things the way that we are looking at the great animated cartoons of, you know, Disney, et al. You know, I've always said, you know, my favorite movie is Fantasia, the 41 version. And that remains the case. I've seen that movie more than any other movie, I think. It's an extraordinary picture. And it is art. Now, you know, Miss Rebert might not think it was, or maybe he thinks it is now, but at the time he wouldn't have. Because, well, boy, it was a cartoon. Come on, guys. He would have been wrong. The men and women who disparaged the movie when it came out from their high moral horses were wrong. And 56 years on, I'm sorry, 66 years on, the movie looked as incredible and mind-blowing as it ever did. That's where games are going.
Well said. Now, what's next for Clive Barker in the realm of games? Obviously, you've done dark topics. You say you have an interest in children's works. Maybe
yeah.
Something that combines the two? Pokemon meets Resident Evil, perhaps?
No, I'm not yet. Resident Evil in the nursery. No, I have a lot of things waiting in the wings, and I'm going to do a big deal, which I can't talk about right now, but which will have me making games for many years to come, and I have two epics that I have structured and are ready to be shared with my creators once my creators have signed the contract. My creative team, I mean, Codemasters. And I am astonished by how far they have gone on my behalf and on behalf of the game to get it right. This is a game that they showed to me in March, and I had some problems with in some places. I gave them notes. They made 57,000 changes. I was awestruck. I mean, that's those changes. And the game became this. And not because of I made all the right moves and said all the right things. It wasn't about that. It was about just saying, go and look at this again and make it more intense. It's in you to do so. And the artist leapt to the challenge. We took off a soundtrack I didn't like and got a magnificent score from Chris Velasco, who's well known to gamers, and he even gave me the boy Soprano, who I keep in a little bottle on my desk. No, he even gave me the boy Soprano to sing in the choir, and I think it's a remarkable game, and I am proud as hell of it. It's lovely to be able to have something that comes from a collective endeavor, and to be able to say, look, this isn't just mine, and I'm saying this right now, and will continue to say this. This belongs to everybody whose name is there on the packaging. It takes more than one person with an idea to make a game. I can barely turn on the light, so my technological skills are somewhat simplistic. Even as a player, I've invented gaming as a spectator sport. I mean, why not? It's actually huge fun to watch people gaming. And the more I've asked people about it, the more I realize that I'm not alone doing that. Just people don't fess up to it. Yeah, I actually like to watch my sister play the game. Yeah, I like to watch my dad, even whatever. It's fun watching people get, you know, into that mode and watching the relationship between what's going on in the screen coming through the body in front of it.
Yeah. And make a great game. So Clive Barker's Game Spotting 2008?
Yeah, there you go. Why not?
You could be the next epic.
Yeah, thank you. Absolutely. But I think it's a you know, like all young things, it has lots of growing to do. But you know, painting has been around for 4,000 years at least. Those marks on the cave in France, I think they think it was about 4,000 years old. And I think it's still a young art. I think it still has lots of places to go, because the human imagination is still opening up so much that we haven't yet imagined.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, you heard it here first, digitaltrends.com, speaking with Clive Barker about his new game, Jericho. Clive, we appreciate your time.
My pleasure.